Good morning. Good to see you all. We're on Yud Chet Amud Bet all the way at the bottom, and we're going to be doing Yud Tet today, turning to the second and then third Mishnah of this second Perek, and there's only a couple duff left of this second Perek. And so far, the first duff articulated how important order is, language is, and we'll get today to the kind of text the Megillah needs to be read from. Again, the first chapter explored, in some ways, the purpose of Purim and this story. The second is the mode of its communication. And we began the chapter with a discussion of the importance of order in the Megillah, in Hallel, in Tefillah, in Shema. As human beings, we need more than just download of information. We need context and order in order to be moved in the correct way. We transitioned into talking about different languages, what if it's in Greek, what if it's in languages we don't understand, at which point one of the sages says, let's be frank, there are things that none of us understand, and yet we have to hear them, even if we don't understand them. There are certain phrases in the Megillah, for example, and they make the point that what we're doing in reciting the Megillah is more than just hearing the story, but we are preserving it in perpetuity for a time when someone might understand this. And in reading it together, we preserve concrete memory, but we also preserve the bonds of solidarity between us. This is a story we've been telling for generations, and we listen to it with each other, and we hear it with each other, which speaks to more than just the information, but the shared experience over time. And it happens to be after we did this last week, Stu Halpern was here talking about the Haggadah, and he quoted Rabbi Sacks and others who said a similar thing about the Haggadah. What we do, we sit down and we tell the story, and that keeps us together over generations as we repeat these bonds of memory. And that's what the Megillah is. Yud Chet Amud Bet, we are three of the narrow lines up. Four, rather. The first one is Mitnamnem. And the end of that first Mishnah describes not only it has to be in order, but you have to be relatively conscious. And this is probably the hardest part for many people thinking about going through the motions, is that awareness, consciousness, intention is important. Mitnanam yatsa. But the Mishnah says, oddly enough, you would think if you have to be engaged, slumbering, you're out. But we say if you're mitnamnem, you fulfill the obligation, even if you're not fully conscious. Heikadamit mitnamnem, the Gemara says, you need to identify with me. Or identify for me what this slumbering means. This is a very concrete question in Jewish life. How conscious do you have to be during the laying of the Megillah to fulfill your obligation? Rav Ashi says, Nim velo nim, tir velo tir, which means you're awake, you're not awake, you're asleep, you're not asleep. Ani, if somebody calls your name, you'll respond. Velo yada lo dorisvara, but you can't really be logical. But if someone reminds you, you can articulate the case. So I'm sure we've all been there. It's the kind of thing where it's hard to define, but you're awake enough that you can respond. You say, don't ask me to. And then if they tell you, you say, yes, that's what I mean. And you're fulfilling your obligation, which again is suggesting this isn't penetrating deep into your psyche because you're so alert and conscious and awake, but it's enough that you are going to have a memory and you're part of the story. Full stop. We said, what happens if you're stumbling? If you're writing the Megillah, and as you're writing it, you're explaining it, do you fulfill the obligation in the process, or does it have to be pre-written as a text? Hechidami, what are you talking about here, the Gemara says, the first medium line. If this is somebody who is saying verse by verse and then writing it down, what difference does it make whether they're paying attention? This is verbal communication. We've already said it needs to be from a text. You can't just say it out loud. Verbally or by heart. So what difference does it make if you write it down after you've said it out loud? It's by mouth. It must be that you're writing pasuk by pasuk. You write down the pasuk and then you say it out loud. You write down the pasuk and then you say it out loud. How can you fulfill your obligation in that way either? It was said in the name of Rav. And this is going to be the next Mishnah we get to in a minute, but it's quoting it now in advance. Halacha kedivrei ha'omer kula. We follow the view that you have to say the whole of Megillah out loud to fulfill your obligation. And even according to the view, you actually don't need to hear the whole of Megillah out loud, just part of it. But even that view says It has to be written out, the whole thing, and you're reading from an entire scroll. That's where we can get to the next Mishnah. If I were to ask you how much of the Megillah do you actually have to hear to fulfill your obligation, what was your gut instinct? Yeah, all of it. That's kind of the standard operating procedure. We're getting the next Mishnah. There are actually four different views, one of which says you only really need to hear from the fifth parak onwards to fulfill your obligation, and the beginning is just kind of window dressing. And as long as you hear from Uvalaila Hahu Nadidashnat Hamelech, you fulfill your obligation. But the Mishnah concludes, even according to those more minimal views, you only have to hear part of it. It has to be read from a scroll that's entirely scripted. So how could we have a possibility that you're writing a pasuk and then saying it out loud? Writing a pasuk, say it out loud, then it's not all written. Yeah.
But if you're writing Megillah, you have to be copying the Megillah from another Megillah. You can't write the Megillah just by memory.
And therefore, you've clearly got a Megillah with you.
Yeah.
So that's where we're headed. Where are we? That second wide line, Ella demancha Megillah kame, must be there's a Megillah already there next to them. The karelemen psuka psuka, and then you're reading it verse by verse, and then you're writing it down. Solved. Lema masayla, and maybe this supports the following view, the Rabbi Bachana of Rabbi Bachana, who says in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, asa l'ktov ot achat shlo minaktav. It is forbidden when you are scripting, or rather, I should say, inscribing a sacred text, to do it without a text in front of you. Doesn't that support that view? That reading, that you must have the text next to you to do the Megillah, sounds like it's enforcing Zach's view that you can only inscribe if you have a text in front of you. No, Dilma Zitrami Leminorami. Maybe it's just describing a case where you happen to be doing that way. It's not conclusive from our reading of that story that that this view says you have to write with a text in front of you to copy. Full stop, Gufa. Now we're going to return to the point that Zachary and others raised. Amar Rabbi Chanan Rabbi Yochanan. Asa, this is now in the orange. Asa lichtov odachat shel maktav. It is forbidden to write a Torah or a sacred text, a Megillah, Tefillin, Mezuzah, any of those things without a text in front of you to copy from. Any of you ever written Torah, Mezuzah, Megillah? If you've written a letter? Right. So is there a Torah next to that Torah that you're writing from when you do that?
No, not really.
It's already there, basically. You're just filling in the letters. But, right, when a sofer is writing a Torah, there is a text there next to them in order to do it. And this is where we explore that possibility. Are there any exceptions to that rule? Medve. We have a brighter first one line is Medve. Amar Shimon Elazar. Masa Bremer. There was a case with Bremer that seems to prove this contention untrue. Shahalach la'av shana ba'asya. He went, it happens to be to extend the year in Asya. La yasha Megillah. And this was in a remote place where they didn't have a Megillah. So v'kad v'milib over v'kara. So he wrote it by heart and they fulfill the obligation. Sounds like you don't need a text to write from if you're copying out a sacred text. You just need to know it. And Rabbah says, Shani Rabmeh. Rabmeh is different. Why is Rabmeh different? He's brilliant. He's got a good memory. There you go. To Mekayim Bey, because about Remer it was said, V'alvafecha yashu nengdecha. Your eyelids are straight before you. What does that mean? Your eyelids are straight before you. Amalei Ramacham Rabbi Yemi Medifti. This is what it means. My v'alvafecha yashu nengdecha. Amalo elu divrei Torah. This is speaking about the words of Torah being before your eyes. Always diktiv behu hitivei necha ve'enein v'bo. Because it says about Torah, your eyes are tired, or you glance at it rather. Your eyes glance at it, and then ve'inenu, it disappears. Usually, how do we experience any information? We look at it, we read it, and then you look away, and then you say, oh, I don't know what, I can't remember what I just saw. That's how Torah usually functions. And yet, afafecha, even though the thing which fleets in terms of memory, yashu langdecha, for Rebbe Meir, filu hachi, miyushu na etzel remei, was in front of him all the time. So where other people, I mean, what would we call this now? What kind of memory?
Photographic
memory. Other people, you look at something, you can't remember it, you forget that you saw it, Rebbe Meir, he would see it, and it would never disappear. Afafecha, yashu necha, it would just be in front of his eyes all the time. So is the exception that Rebbe Meir was a sacred guy, or is this a technical exception? It's a practical thing, meaning the whole problem, why do you need a text next to you? Is it because it doesn't chal kedusha if you don't have a text next to it? Or it's like we're worried about transmission error. And if Rav Meir has got the text in his head, we're not worried about transmission error. I mean, I guess a contemporary version of this question would be, I don't have a Megillah to copy from. Can I use Safaria? Can I pull something up on my phone? You know, meaning I don't have like the chal shem of Kedusha from a Megillah next to me, but I've got the text here. Is that reliable? So that would be the question. For Meir says there's an exception. Rav Chisda Ashkel Rav Chananel, we're going to say, hold on a minute, we've got another case. Rav Chisda was in front of Rav Chananel. Dava Kalev Shrom Shlomi Nechtav, and he was doing the same thing. He was writing sefer after sefer after sefer without copying it from a text. Amalei, in his response, Rav Chisda said to him, Ru'uya kol ha-Torah kula lichtav al picha, I recognize that you are fitting to have the entire Torah written by heart by you, see, presumably, because you've got a photographic memory. I recognize that. Ella, but this is what the sages say. You can't write a single letter without a text. That sounds like this is not about a technical memory issue. You need to have a sacred scroll next to you in order to transfer Kedusha in some sense. And now the Gemara is contrasting this with what we just said about Reb Meir. So the fact that Reb Chisda said to him, oh, it would be fitting for the whole Torah to be written by you, sounds like he's got this photographic memory that Reb Meir had. For Reb Meir Ketav, and Reb Meir did it. So how do we square these two contrasting traditions? One is Reb Meir wrote it, and we said, oh, Reb Meir's different because he remembers everything. We said, well, there was another case of a rabbi who's got a perfect memory, and Reb Chisda said to him, I know you've got a perfect memory, but the sages say, you can't do this. So how could Reb Meir do it? Answer, Shadadchak Shani, you're right. We're not going to let Reb Meir go and do it, you know, just for the sake of it. If you're stuck in Issa trying to extend the year and you don't have a scroll there, Shadadchak, you can do it. But it's not ideal. Full stop.
It sounds like a transmission issue.
Right, meaning otherwise, why would you permit it? Well, you could say, Shadadchak, we defer to it just being a transmission issue. But in an ideal case, it's not just about transmission. Otherwise, we would let someone with a memory get away with it in any event. And really, it's kind of a sacred passing on of story. It's got to be in front of you to get it script correctly. But you're right, maybe it's a transmission issue and we just say we're less concerned in an emergency case. But we want to put all the... what was it? I think Antonin Scalia once wrote in a Supreme Court position that someone was being very worried. And he said, "It's a, what is that thing you wear on trousers to hold them up?
Belt and suspenders."
Thank you. He said, belt and suspenders, try to caution. Well, like you have a belt and suspenders. So maybe we've got belt and suspenders when it comes to the ideal. And in Shadadchak, we say, all right, you can let go of the suspenders. Okay. Abaya Shadle Reb Chaba. Abaya was with Rabbi Bar Chabo, Mechtav Tfilin Mezuzot Shel Mechtav, and he was writing Tfilin and Mezuzot, not from text. So even though we said you can't write even a single letter while you're not copying from an already sacred text, with Tfilin and Mezuzot, he was doing that all the time. Kaman, who was that like? Ki Haitana, the Tana, was like the following teaching, Rabbi Yimer of Mishmur Rabbeinu, Tfilin and Mezuzot, Mechtav Shel Mechtav, Rein Tzirchem, Sirtut, Tfilin and Mezuzot are different. Now, why might Tfilin and Mezuzot be different?
It's smaller. Easy to remember.
Right, so if this is just about transmission, we don't need belt and suspenders. They're much shorter, it's much more fluent. Like if I asked, you know, any of you to say, you know, could you say the Bracha Brei Priya Itzov by heart, I imagine you'd have more confidence than if I said, could you say Ruchas Krishma off by heart. It's just longer, even though you may say it with similar frequency. When it's shorter, there's less worry. Tefillin and Mezuzah don't have to be written from the previous text, and they don't need Sirta, which is the engraved lines that you write on. The Hilchata, and this is the bottom line ruling, second line up, Tfilin ain't Tzrichim Sirtut, Mezuzot Tzrichim Sirtut, Tfilin don't need those, what is the word I'm looking for? Engraved, I'm not looking for, imprinted lines. Say again?
Embossed.
Now maybe that's what embossed means, poking out, right?
Yeah, no.
Embedded.
Pushed in, embedded, embossed lines. But Mezuzot do need them. Yeah. So but both of them don't need a text. My Tama Migris Grisin, because you're familiar with them. So the full stop, it does seem this is all about transmission issues. And this reinforces the point we've been making over the last half and a half since the beginning of this perek, that the key factor when it comes to telling the Megillah and writing the Megillah and reading the Megillah is transmission, not in this instant, but over time. Preserving the story is key. There's a huge amount of anxiety around losing track of this story. Now, of course, the Sefer Torah has got its own rules about preservation, but the Megillah, I think, oh, this is, you know, a side story. I'll get the spirit of it. I don't need to get every word, every letter. And here we think the Megillah is basically like a Sefer Torah. And it is as important to the Jewish national psyche as much as the Torah is in terms of the Jewish moral psyche. If you don't hold on to this story for every letter, every inflection, even if you don't know what it all means, you have to keep it preserved because it will preserve our story. Full stop. The next three lines is something that I imagine is not going to stick with us. Haitak Tuvra Basama has to be written with certain materials. And now I'm going to just read to you and literally translate by just repeating the words. Sam. What is Sam that it says it has to be written in? Sama. Sikra. What is Sikra that has to be written with? Amar Bachana. Sikrata Shma. It's Sikrata. And I could tell you, you know, what kind of gall wood this is in English, but I wouldn't know, and I imagine most of you wouldn't know what it is either. But this is defining the ingredients it has to be written in. Kumus. It has to be written with a kumus, which is kuma. Top of Yutet Amad Aleph. Kankantum has to be written with Kankantum. Charata de Ushpachi, which is a kind of dye that they use to darken shoes. Diftera has to be written on a certain kind of parchment. Demeliach v'kamiach, which is treated with salt and with flour below office, but not with gall wood. Nayar, and it could be on paper. Mechka, which is also known as mechka, which is a kind of reed that grows by the bank of rivers. Okay, so it's just defining what it has to be written with. In the Mishnah, it says it has to be written in Hebrew letters. How do I know? It has to be written in your language, as for your time. So it tells me it has to be written in Hebrew. Even though we said on the last page that in theory, maybe there's an exception if it's written in Greek. But well, that's not the way we fall long term. Allah Sefer Diyah has to be written on a book and with ink. It can't be written in something else. Minalan, how do I know? Adjective ktiva, there is a gzereshava where it says the word katav twice. Tivhacha in the Megillah, it says v'tikatev Esther Malka, Esther wrote it. Tivhatam, and there in Yirmiyahu, it quotes Baruch as saying, v'yomalem Baruch, Baruch said, mipiv yikare elai, it was said to me by mouth, it called Ramela, all these, v'ani kotev ala sef, and I'm going to write them on a parchment in ink. The fact that it says ktiva with Esther and it says ktiva with Baruch suggests that they should be in the same thing. It's got to be written in a firm way. Full stop, end of reflections on that first mission of the Perek, which is about order and transmission. Now we head to the second mission, where there are two parts to this Mishnah, and then over the page of Ted Ahmed Bet, third way down, we have a Mishnah about who can read the Megillah for other people, where there will be a question of whether somebody who is what do you call someone who has no hearing in a non-offense? Is that acceptable? No, mutes, you can't speak. Okay, so if somebody is deaf, they can't hear. I don't know, but I sometimes from England, things we say are not acceptable to say here. Deaf. But we also call people handicapped, and I'm told that's...
Handicapped is a broad term.
No, but I'm just saying we use words that in America people would frown upon. Am I incorrect? Yeah, but there's a machine here. Worse, oh, now I'm in trouble. That's true. I discovered that actually this week at YU, there was a term I kept using, and they kept like snickering, and then being like, you know, that sounds really rude. I'm like, why? And then I explained, and they're like, oh, yeah, that's not what it sounds like. So I've now stopped using that term, but leaving you with a curiosity as to what it was. So, Yutet Amud Aleph, about eight lines down Mishnah. We've said in the first perek we examined there are three places which define when you can read the Megillah. You can be in a walled city when you have to read it on which day? 15th, Shushan Purim on the 15th. If you're in not a walled city but a city, you read it on the 14th. And if you live out in a village or a town or a hamlet that's not even a city, you can read it on 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th for various reasons. So now the question, and this comes up a lot in Israel around Purim, what happens if you travel to one of those places? You know, I live out in Netanya, which is not a walled city from the time of Joshua ben Nun, so I'm going to do Purim on the 14th, but I want to get, you know, a bunch of parties in. Or I'm from Yerushalayim and I want to go out to Tel Aviv for reading on the 14th. Have I fulfilled my obligation when I get back to Yerushalayim? Do I have to read it again in Yerushalayim? Where do I live if I'm traveling around? Ben ish alach lekrach. If somebody is a city dweller, not a walled city, and they go to a walled city, or vice versa, Im atid lachzor limkomo koru kimkomo. If you plan to go back to the place where you live, you read according to that. So on the face of it, what does it sound like? If you're from Yerushalayim and you go out to Tel Aviv, how should you be reading? 15th. If you plan to go back. If you plan to go back, when?
By the 15th, I guess.
Right, so it kind of leaves it open. At what point? What if I say I'm going to go back midday on the 15th? Or what if I'm decided I'm going to go back on the 16th? Do I read it in Tel Aviv on the 15th because I plan to go back? It seems unclear, so we're going to have to define that in the Gemara. So you read it according to your place of viewing. But if you don't plan to go back, Kara Mahem, you should read it in the place you are in. Mehechan Kara, and now this is the second part of the Mishnah. How much of the Megillah do you need to read? V'yazabiyadei chavata to fulfill your obligation. Three views in the Mishnah. Rebbe Omer Kuli, you have to read the whole Mishnah, the whole Megillah. Rebbe Yehuda Omer Meish Yehudi, you only have to read essentially from the third chapter when Mordechai is introduced. Rabbi Yossi says actually it's later in the third chapter after Haman emerges. So this is again intriguing innovation suggestions that you don't have to hear the whole Megillah, which is going to boil down in the Gemara to, so what is the source for this, but what is the logic for why you wouldn't have to read the whole Megillah? And we're going to get four different readings of what the purpose of Megillah reading is. Amar Rava, Rava says, talking about the first part of the Mishnah, that depending on where you live, Lo shanu elishati lachzor b'leila yudalit. The whole key, Rava says, is if you plan to go back, I mean, it makes no sense. You go to Yerushalayim from the outskirts. We say you should read according to the place you're from if you plan to go back. So let's say I go to Yerushalayim on the 11th, and I plan to go back to Tel Aviv on the 18th. So I should read it. I'm planning to go back, so I should read it according to the schedule of Tel Aviv in Yerushalayim on the day before Purim. That obviously doesn't make any sense. So it means if you are from Yerushalayim and you go to the outskirts and you're there on the night of the 14th, you're having a big party, Purim night, am I meant to read the Megillah now? From Yerushalayim, I just traveled here for the party, am I meant to read it? And it says, if you plan to go back before daybreak, you don't have to. You're just there for the party. So what defines your residency for the purposes of Purim, if you're there by sunrise, the morning of the obligation for the morning Megillah, and the assumption among the commentaries is, because the main Megillah reading is in the morning. So if you're there at sunrise, that defines your obligation. Aval, einatid, this is the second green line. Einatid lachzor b'leila arba asar karim. If you don't plan to go back on the 14th at night, like, I'm going to go back 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, you have to read according to Tel Aviv, even if you're in Yerushalayim. Amar Rava, Rava says, man amina, how do I know this? Where's this whole principle from, that if I'm there for one day, I establish residency, I'm there overnight, now I need to read there? I'm going back to Yerushalayim at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, why should I have to read it in Tel Aviv if I'm there just overnight? Dichtiv, it says, in the Megillah, I'll call you Dima Prazim, and all the scattered Jews, Hayashim Ba'ari Brazot, who live in the scattered towns. Michti, let's see. Tivi Yudima Prazim. It says already the scattered Jews have an obligation. I mean, in the Michti, why does it have to add, and there's an obligation to all the scattered Jews and all the Jews who live in scattered cities? Why does it have to repeat that information? I mean, in the Michti, why does it have to add, it must be teaching. The Paras Ben Yomo Nikra Paras. That if you're there overnight, it's as if you're scattered and you're identified with those places. Ashkachan Paras. Okay, I take your word for it that means that if you go out to a scattered place overnight, that's your residency. Mukaf Manale. How do I know if I go to a walled city for one night that you have to identify with that place? Svaro, it's just logic. I mean, the Paras Ben Yom Makori. Paras Mukaf Ben Yom Makori Mukaf. Overnight residency counts as residency for this purpose. It's just based on logic. There are sorts of questions we can raise about the limit here, but that seems to be the position it takes. For Amarava, in the pink Amarava, Ben Kfar Shahalach Le'ir. Okay, so we bring up this village now. Let's say you're from the village. What days did we say you can read it in the village? 11th through 14th. So let's say you're from the village. You go to the city. It says, Ben Kach U Ben Kach Kora Mehem. Either way. Let's say from the city. I heard it on the 11th. I now go to the city. Sorry, I'm from a hamlet or a town. I heard it on the 11th. I go to the city on the 14th at night. So I want to be there for the big party in the city, Purim party. But I plan to leave in the morning. I'm not going to be there past 3 a.m. What do we say really defines residency?
You are in the morning.
Being there till the morning. So I'm not going to be there in the morning. I'm from the hamlet. I come into the big city, not walled. I'm going to be there 14th at night for a party. They're going to read the Megillah. Do I have to listen? Or can I say I did the Megillah on the 11th? I'm not interested. I'm going to sit outside until the party starts. So Rava says, if you're ben kfar shalach le'ir, if you're from the hamlet and you come to the city, ben kach uven kach, whether you're going to be there in the morning or not, kareh mahem, you have to hear the Megillah. You're there 14th at night, you're there for the party, you have to hear the Megillah that night, even though you're not going to be there in the morning. My tama, what's the reason? We said that residency is defined by being there overnight. Answer, hai kibnei ir bai lemikri. Because really, if you live out in the hamlet, when is your obligation to hear the Megillah? 14th. And the rabbis are lenient and give you some leeway, but really that's your central obligation. So this isn't really about residency. This is about, if you're there, this is your real obligation. If you're out in the boondocks, I guess is the word, you got flexibility, but really your obligation is on the 14th. If you live in Yerushalayim and you go to Tel Aviv, you don't have an obligation on the 14th unless you're a resident. But out in the, if you live out in the towns, that is your obligation anyway. That's only they are lenient when you're out there. Beduchte, literally translating the boondocks. But if you come to the city, you are somebody who has a 14th in obligation. You have to read it then. Eidva, Abai is going to ask a question about this, because he has a teaching, a following brighter. Ben krach shalach le'ir. If you're from Yerushalayim and you go to Tel Aviv, ben kach uven kach kim kamo. Either way, you have to read according to your place, meaning you have to read according to Yerushalayim. That's what the brighter says. This conflicts with everything. How? What do we do with this? Ben krach shalach adatach. You think that that brighter really meant to say ben krach? It can't be that. We said, but im atid lachso chalim elte. It depends on where you plan to be. So that can't be what it means. It must mean El alav ben kfar. It must mean if you're ben kfar, you read according to your own place, which is the opposite of what Rava just said, that if you're ben kfar, you have to read according to your dalit. Falav terutzim et teratzta, the Gemara says, you just gave your answer. You just told me that the whole brayta is corrupted. So, like, we're not going to rely on it anyway. Tani korim hem, so change the end. You change the beginning from ben krach to ben kfar, change the end, kim kamo, to korim hem. So I'm not going to take that as a valid argument, which sounds like an incidental point, but again, if we're thinking about the theme of transmission and accuracy, once you introduce a small problem, it corrupts everything and you lose credibility, you lose confidence in the whole script, which again turns on the question of the importance of how this is written, when it's written from beginning to end. Transmission issues are serious problems, and it's not incidental, meaning whether you live in the city or not, whether you're reading with them or not, you change a small detail that can have rapid ripple effects across the board, which is why we need to preserve it. Full stop. Second part of the Mishnah says, how much of the Megillah do you have to read to fulfill your obligation? Which is another way of saying, what's the key part of this story? Mehechan kara adam et Megillah, we said. And in the Mishnah, we had three possibilities. Either you got to read the whole thing, or you got to read from Ishu D when Mordechai is introduced, or you got to read Bachad Verma Eila when Haman comes on the scene. Middle of the night in yellow. Tanya, it was Torah Shumva Yochai Omer. He has a fourth possibility. You only have to read Mibalaila Hahu from the fifth perek. Half the Megillah you don't need to read to fulfill your obligation. This is not the Chatchila B'di'eved. He says, you know, you people are always interested in short, you know, I want a Hashkama Minyan, I want a quick Minyan, I want a no frills. When I was in Chicago, they had like three different readings on Purim night. They had like the frills, the no frills, and the no, really, no frills. And it was like, whoomp, you're like 10 minutes, you're done. So they could have been a no frills half the time, because we're only going to do from the fifth perek on. That's Rav Shimon bar Yochai. Rabbi Yochanan says, V'kulan mikra echa darshu. You should know all four views of how much Megillah you need to read. Get their view based on one single verse. And this speaks to the point we raised last week as well, which is what's important about transmission can be ruined in translation. Because even if you have the exact same content, if it's transplanted to another language, ambiguities may be lost. And here they're all looking at the same text to derive how much of the Megillah you should be reading. What does it say? Tikatav Esther Amalka Mordechai Yudi et Kol Tokef. That when they were speaking about the story was written down, they wrote down et Kol Tokef. What does Tokef mean? Tikifa? It kind of means power. Tokef, it kind of means power. This comes up a lot in contemporary halachic literature about what a Jewish state should look like, what kind of halachic reality it should have. If we have tokef, if we have power, that's very different. If we don't have power, etc. So they said, we wrote this whole story about power. The lesson of Purim is about the importance of power. Okay, the importance of what power? If I said, oh, you have to know the lesson of Purim is the importance of power, how many different interpretations of what that might mean can you imagine? Importance of what power? Four, there you go. So that's exactly what we're going to line out. Manda Amakula, the one who says you have to read the whole Megillah, based on that says, do you know what the lesson is of Purim? Tokfa Shel HaShverosh. It's telling you the importance of the power of who's in charge. If we're here right now in an election season, leading up to the presidential election in November, everyone thinks the person who's in charge is really important. You know, if they are senile, not senile, narcissistic, not narcissistic, reliable, not the questions about the person who actually has power. That's the most central and important point. That's for Rabbi Yochanan. That's a view that you have got to read the whole Megillah. The lesson is, how did this whole thing unfold? It would have been impossible if it was not Achashverosh, who is this flimsy back and forth, I'll trust my advisor, I'm not going to pay attention to the policy, I'll just give him the ring, and then I hear what Mordechai says, and then I hear what... This flippant personality, the person who's in charge is really important. That's the message of the Megillah for this first. Manda, I'm a Mishyudi. The person who says, you only have to read from Mishyudi onwards, Tokfo Shel Mordechai, says, no, it's the lesson of the Megillah is the power that a single conscientious citizen can have, a saint, a sage, however you want to read Mordechai's character. That's the lesson of the Megillah. It doesn't matter who's in charge. What matters is that you have a conscientious objector or analyst who's on the outside trying to figure out how to save the Jews. You know, Achashverosh, not Achashverosh, who cares? Without a Mordechai, nothing happens. That's the second possibility. The person who says you only have to read once Haman is introduced tells you, the lesson of the Megillah is not... Does it matter whether Biden or Trump is in charge, or does it matter who his advisors are, or who the Secretary of State is, which is not something you can necessarily control in an election? So that's the third possibility, that the lesson of the Megillah is Haman is the real criminal here, and it shows you that a civil servant can have far more impact than a person in charge and has untold power. Number four, Mandar Ulalehu Shemarachai says you don't have to read from the middle of the Megillah onwards, tells you, Tokfo Shel Neis, the power of providence. You know, Achashverosh is a pawn in the scheme of things, so is Haman, so is Mordechai. Really, the lesson of the Megillah is that God can intervene in unpredictable, unthinkable ways. And those are four very different lessons to draw from the same story and impact how much of it you need to say. But all agree, we said, the whole thing has to be written. So you have to have the whole text, the whole story preserved. But the question, how much do I have to read and really internalize? Rabbuna says, I disagree with Rabbi Yochanan. They all read a different verse to establish the ways that you need to read the Megillah Mehache. And he says all four of them get it from here. It says in the Megillah that Esther wrote this thing called Tokef, and they wrote, Umar ra'u al-kacha, what did they see about this? Umar gilem, and what happened to them? The lesson, Rav Huna says, of the Megillah that wants to impart is the import of cause and effect. That's what the Megillah is. Not about power. It's about cause and effect. Now, if you were saying it was about cause and effect, which part of the Megillah do you have to read? Which cause, which effect is the most important lesson? And this is, again, going to be played through these four possibilities. Manda Makula, the one who says you have to read the whole Megillah, and it's a story about cause and effect. Mara'a, the cause it's thinking about, what did Achashverosh Shnishtamish Bekelim Shal Beit HaMikdash, that he used the vessels of the temple, Al-Kacha, the reason that he used them, Mishum Dechashiv Shivim Shinim V'lo Ifrit, because the 70 years went and came, and they weren't redeemed. That's the cause. The Achashverosh started using all the sacred vessels because he thought 70 years had been predicted for the Jewish return, came and went, they didn't go back. Hey, hope's over. So the cause is, celebrating the end of hope. Umay gialehem, and what happened as a result? Dekatel Vashti. Vashti died. So for this view that you have to read the whole Megillah, really the most important part is the first chapter, which we kind of forget. That's kind of like window dressing for many of us. Vashti come, doesn't come, dies. And now you've got Mordechai and Esther and Haman, that's the story. For this first reading, actually, the beginning of the Megillah is the most important, because it's teaching you the lesson that if you lose hope, or if you don't trust Jewish hope and prophecies, it'll come back on you and haunt you. Mandama Mishudi, the one who says you have to read from Mordechai's introduction, says, what's the cause and effect you have to think about? Mara Mordechai Dignin Bahaman. What was the reason Mordechai triggered Haman. Why did he refuse to bow to him? Al-Kacha, for the following reason, because he made himself an idolater. So the cause is Mordechai refuses to bow to an idol. And what was the result? There was a miracle. Cause and effect, you're a religious objector, you have religious conviction, miracles will come. That's the lesson, and that's why you have to read about Megillah. You have to read from Mordechai and on. The person who says you have to read from Haman and onwards, what's the message? Not that Haman has power, but the following truth. What led Haman to target all of the Jews? Al-Kacha, for the following reason, because Mordechai didn't bow down. So the step one that you need to see is that Haman got angry with all the Jews because Mordechai refused to bow down. So what is the cause we're looking at?
The opposite one right before.
Right. We had Mordechai represented religious conviction and willing to stand up. Haman represents narcissism. No one's bowing to me. And as a result, I'm going to project that on everybody. So that's step one. Step two, my Yilem, what happened? V'shalavatov ben Avala Eitz, he and all his kids were hanged on a tree. So what is the lesson of the Megillah? We've got three different possibilities so far within this reading of cause and effect. One is, if you doubt the Jews' hope, you're going to end up with your family ruined. If you stand up as a religious objector, you're going to lead to miracles. If you start projecting hatred on all the Jews, you're also going to end up with your whole family hanging on a tree. So those are three different possibilities. The person who says that actually you only need to read the last half of the Megillah, fifth chapter and on. What is the cause and effect? What caused Achashverosh to get out the chronicles? Bad dream. He couldn't sleep. Why couldn't he sleep? Al-Kacha. That Esther invited Haman to be with her for the party, and that made him, we read this a few daf ago, started eating away at him, and he got suspicious. Maybe they're having a relationship. Maybe there's something I missed. Why hasn't anyone told me about this plot? I need to have the chronicles read to me. And what was the result? There was a miracle. So what's the lesson? It seems to be in this last reading that Esther's diplomacy was wise. She invited Haman, which triggered Achashverosh not to sleep, and that led to miracles. So again, altogether we have eight different possibilities as to how much of the Megillah you need to read and what is the overarching story. And even if you pick one of those four views, you only have to read half, you've got to read the whole thing. There are different lessons. So you've got to read the whole thing. Why? Either because it's telling you the importance of monarchy, the person in charge has a significant amount of power, that's the lesson of the whole Megillah. Or the lesson of the whole Megillah is, even if you're in power, if you ignore the Jewish hope, you're going to end up dead. So there are very different readings you get from the whole Megillah. But we preserve the whole story. And again, this seems to be suggesting one of the reasons you have to preserve the whole text in every single letter is because it holds so many different meanings. And don't think, oh, I know what it means. I'll give you a paraphrase. I'll give you the spark notes. If you don't read the whole thing, you are essentially going to miss all sorts of possibilities. Say again? Esther and Mordechai. They wrote the Megillah together. Meaning,
why are we dissecting it?
It's a good question, and the answer is that there's no chiyuv to read Megillat Rut. That's minhag. But this is a mitzvah d'rabbanan. There is no other than the Sefer Torah. There is no other sacred text that there is a mitzvah to read it.
Like Shir Shirim and Kohelet, no mitzvah to read that.
No, those are just minhagim. Yeah. So this is. And we'll actually make that point in a moment over the page. Which one? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, let's just forget it all. Jewish life blends things together because we treat everything rightfully as equally important. And here the Gemara is kind of bearing down on what is it about Megillah that's so key and so important, and it's got to be written on a cloth. And as an example, the Megillah has to be read from a cloth. You can't get out of books. Shir Shirim, Eicha, we read it from there are some communities that read it out of a cloth, but that's also a kind of minhag that developed over time.
And they make a bracha.
Say again?
And they make a bracha on Kriyas Megillah if they use the Megillah.
Right, the Vilna Gaon and some of the followers of his will say a bracha on Shir Shirim and Kohelet when they read it out of a cloth. Eicha, I don't think.
No.
Yeah, I don't know. But Yeah, so Purim does seem to be exceptional. It is the and we said this maybe 12 daf ago when we said Chazal promised they're not going to introduce anything after the prophets apart from reading Megillah. That was added. And we needed to justify this is like a radical departure. It's not just a minhag, it's like a mitzvah to do it. And we're going to get over the page. Who has to read it? How does it have to be written, etc.? So, six lines up. Pink. Amrav Chalba, Amrav Chalba, Ragui, Amarav. Halacha, Kedivra, Uma, Kula. We follow the law at the position that you have to read the whole thing. And even according to the view that you don't have to read the whole thing has to be written down. Full stop. End of. That discussion. We're now going to pick up a different statement from Mechalba Amarav, Mechalba Amarguya Amarav. And this again, we're now teetering in between. Is the Megillah a rabbinic version of a Sefer Torah? Does it have that kind of quality to it? Or is it different in some ways? We seem to be saying so, but it has to be written with proper ink, has to be written on proper cloth, has to be written from beginning to end, has to be written in Asherit. Sounds like Chazal say everything that's true about a Sefer Torah is true about the Megillah. So is that true across the board, or are there other differences, and we're about to enunciate them? Yeah.
I was just wondering, back to the beginning of the Mishnah, when the conversation goes about somebody who comes from one of the distant villages,
yeah,
and is in Tel Aviv, is in the city for the 14th. There's no similar discussion about somebody who's in a walled city who comes to a regular city. In this Mishnah.
No, so the Mishnah says, Bein ir shalach lekrach, uven krach shalach leir. So if you're in a walled city and you go to a regular city as well.
Because the explanation we said was that we have for the distant
so it would be,
city, the 14th is really the right day he should be doing it.
Yeah.
So we give him leeway for the 11th and the 12th and the 13th. So if he's actually there the 14th, he should be included again for the 14th. But that's not the same Svara for somebody who's in a walled city.
Correct.
They don't actually have to be there for the 14th.
Correct, which is why for them, they only have to read on the 14th if they're there until daylight. But we said, for if you come from a village, if you're there when they're doing Megillah, you have to hear it. But if you come from a walled city, in either direction, if you're there by daylight, you have to read the Megillah with them, otherwise you don't.
Even though it's not...
You have no obligation, but you establish residency. And then the Gemara said, why? They said, because it says, Hayoshvim b'prazei ha'ir, says twice, if you're scattered and if you're dwelling with the scattered. So it makes it sound like if you're there, you have to read the story. Which I guess it also cements this point about preserving the story. You can't, you know, go and sit in a place where everybody's reading and say, I'm not listening, I'm not interested. I'm only here for the day. You're here for the day, you have to pay attention to the story. And again, you can make homiletics out of that about when you're displaced. You know, I'm displaced for a week. I don't read it one year. This came up, you know, during COVID. It's an exceptional year. Let's, you know, skip something. And there's a lot of resistance to saying, you think one year, a lot of things can be forgotten in one year. And it came out the year once all the COVID restrictions dropped. A lot of people said, what did we do 2 years ago? What did we do just because of COVID? I don't remember. So, you know, you're there for one day, do what they do here, seems to be the assumption. Good question. So, again, second medium line up. Amar v'chabar rav v'gumir amar rav. Megillah nikrat sefer nikrat igeret. In the Megillah itself, the Megillah is referred to as a sefer, and it's referred to as an igeret. One sounds like a scroll, like a Torah, and then igeret sounds like a letter, which is far more casual. Or flimsy. Nikret Sefer is called Sefer to tell you Shim Tifra Bechutei Pishdam Sula, that if you stitch together the different parts of parchment with flax, that don't work. It's parcel. Which again suggests that there is something formal, sacred about this. It's not just about the information. It can't just be stitched in a way that keeps it together. There has to be something similar to the sacred text. V'nigret igeret, and the fact that it's called a letter mitigates that in some way. Shim hitel b'shlosha chutin, chutei gidin k'sheira, that if the stitching, there's only three bits stitching across, usually you've got to say for Torah, how much percentage-wise stitching do there have to be from top to bottom? Would you guess? 51, interesting. So it's actually like 98%. The stitching has to go all the way, but you leave a little bit at the top, a little bit at the bottom. When it comes to the Megillah, it's saying you only have to have just three stitches, basically. So that's how it's in a Geret, but it's also a Sefer that it has to be with Gidin. It can't be with flax. Amar of Nachman. Rav Nachman says, Rivashish Meshulashin, just to the point, he adds, if you have three stitches, you know, let's say this is the top, the bottom of the cloth, where, in theory, could I put three stitches to fulfill this obligation? Anyway, I could just do one, two, three at the bottom, and that's all laid up. So he says, I'm just adding, it has to be Meshulashin, you have to divide it into three. You know, don't think, I put three stitches and I'll end, and it has to still be held together. It just doesn't have to be tight all the way along. Amar Yudamar Shmuel, second line from the bottom. Hakar Megillah Ktuvah Ben Ktuvim Lo Yatza. This is important. What happens if I've got Tanakh written in a scroll, and as part of Tanakh, I've got Megillat Esther in there, and I read the story of Megillat Esther out of a full Tanakh that's written properly with all the dio and all the sefer. Lo Yatza, says Shmuel, you have not fulfilled your obligation. Amar Rava, Rava says Lo Amar Me'elid Loi Machzor Me'itre Purte Ava Machzor Me'itre Purte Leit Lamba. Says, well, actually, if it's written in a big scroll where all of Tanakh is, but the one, the area where the Megillah is, the parchment is shorter or taller, that's fine. It has to be distinct in some way and unique. So this again comes to the point, is Megillat Esther more sacred than the rest of Tanakh, less sacred than the rest of Tanakh? It seems to be this is just distinct. Chazal are trying to put a huge amount of emphasis. This story is definitive for Jewish existence in diaspora, and you have to demonstrate its significance and how different it is in multiple ways. It has to be like a Sefer Torah, and if it's with everything else, even if it's got those standards, it has to be taller or shorter in some way as well. Leiva Bar Shmuel, bottom of the page, last line. Leiva Bar Shmuel, Kari Kamed Rav Yehuda Ben Megillah Ktuvah. Leiva Bar Shmuel was before Yehuda, and he read a Megillah that was written, Ben Ktuvim, among other scriptures. Amalein, he said, Hari Amru Akor Megillah Ktuvim Lo Yatza. And they said to him, you've not fulfilled your obligation doing that. Full stop. That's just making the point that there is another view that takes this position. You can't just have all the technical requirements fulfilled and have it surrounded by other stories. It has to be distinct. Megillat Esther in some way. Amru Chiba Avim Rabbi Yochanan Akor Megillah Ktuvim Ktuvim Lo Yatza. Rabbi Yochanan is quoted as saying the same thing. Umachula Amucha, which translates roughly as, and he smashed it on the brain. Which he says this, but then he kind of weakens the point and says, but Bitsibur Shanu, he added, it's only when it's in public that it has to be distinct. But if you read it privately, you do the Megillah by yourself, it doesn't have to be, you know, you're not making this demonstration for yourself. When you're doing a public recitation, you're making the point that this story is distinct and different. So he kind of weakens the point that it needs to be that distinct. Full stop, we're now going to have a series of remarks where people say something and then weaken the case. Va'amr b'chir barab Rabbi Yochanan, same characters, say the name of Rabbi Yochanan. Shir ha-tefer halach l'moshe misina. He said, remember I said about the Sefer Torah, it's going to be 98%, the top and the bottom percent don't have stitching. That's not, you don't have to, you're not allowed to have stitching all the way to the top or the bottom. And he says, that's halach l'moshe misina. You cannot, just illogical or not based on rationale. God says you can't have stitching all the way to the top or all the way to the bottom in a Torah. He said that. And then he kind of smashed it on the head by saying, well, it's not really a biblical prohibition, but it was a rabbinic obligation. What's the logic of saying you shouldn't stitch all the way to the top or the bottom? Say again? Well, that was my initial thinking as well, that if you stitch it all the way to the top or the bottom, it actually is, it'll tear more easily. Rashi reads a little differently, maybe it's similar. He says, if it's stitched all the way to the top or the bottom, and you start rolling it really, really tight, at what point are you going to realize that you're rolling it too tight? When the whole thing rips. If it's got a little bit of give at the top or bottom, you start rolling, if it's getting too tight, what's going to give you an indication already? It starts stretching a little bit. So you have an indication that it's about to give. So Chazal say you have to leave the top and bottom percent so that when you're rolling, you can see if it's getting too tight. Which, if we were into homiletics on every line, you know, there's a lot to say about sometimes being over-secure, not giving you an indication of weakness over time, which makes you more weak and vulnerable. You can say, you know, belt and suspenders, I've got every precaution in place. But when you've got every precaution in place, sometimes you can't see when weaknesses are being tested because you're so secure. And we don't have to talk about October 7th and feeling like I've got cameras and this and that and the other, and you just kind of lie on your laurels and you don't pay attention because you feel so secure, and then you get shocked. That's, again, not a direct parallel, but there's a theme there that sometimes you can feel over secure and actually leaving a couple of vulnerabilities so you can see when things are becoming more contentious. And this speaks to religious life, ethical life, communal life, relationships, national life, but I guess for our purposes, also just the scroll, not ripping. Another saying, the name Rabbi Yochanan, we're going to have two more in his name, not directly connected, it seems. Rabbi Yochanan said, "Ilmale nishtaya b'mara," if somebody was standing near the cave, "Sha'amar b'moshe v'eliyahu kimla nekav," "Ilmale nishtaya b'mara," if there was remaining in the cave, "Sha'amar b'moshe v'eliyahu," that where Moshe and Eliyahu were standing when Hashem was near them, "kimla nekav machatz dakit," just a tiny little hole the size of a sewing needle. If you had a tiny little hole just in the side of the cave where Moshe Olau were during divine revelation, you would not be able to withstand the light. As it says, that no one can see me and live. Why does he say this? How is this pertinent? What is the relevance? I'll leave that to you. But there is a sense that a tiny shed of divine light can be overwhelming. And maybe this speaks to the point we're making that don't underestimate the difference a tiny speck can make. In terms of divine light, it would knock your socks off, it would knock you down. In terms of a small error, transmission can get completely ruined. And people always use this example, if you're firing a rocket into space and you're off by just a tiny sliver of a degree, you end up in a completely different galaxy. So the point being, small errors shouldn't be understated, and tiny things can have a huge impact. Another in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, why does it say in the context of Moshe, and for you are all these words which God told for you on the mountain? Why does it say kachol hadvarim as opposed to just hadvarim, the words that were said, all the words that were said? Melamed, it teaches us, Sharok HaRosh Baruch Hu LeMoshe, that God showed to Moshe at the time when the Torah was being dictated. Dikdukei Torah, all the potential implications of the words of the Torah, Dikdukei Sofrim, and all the implications that Chazal would make on the various shapes of the letters, etc. Umasha Sofrim Atidin LeChadesh, and that which the sages would institute later in time. Moshe was even showed that. And what is that? My Nihu, what was instituted by the Sofrim? Mikra Megillah. Full stop, reading the Megillah. So this is a way of tying reading Megillah to Revelation itself. So in the context of talking about the importance of every letter, jot and tittle and detail, that has room for implications later down the line. Full stop. Next Mishnah. Hakol Sheirin Likro et Megillah Chus Mecher Shed V'Katan. We say everybody can read the Megillah. And we've just said that the stakes cannot be overstated how important this story is. Every letter, every inflection, it's got to be written as if it's a Sefer Torah. It's got to be stitched properly. And now we're saying anyone can read it. You might have thought that as part of their decree, Chazal will say you've got to have the sage read it, you've got to have a scholar read it, you've got to have a Mordechai read it. Anyone can read it, with the three following exceptions. Chutz, mecheresh, shoze, v'katan. Someone who is deaf. Usually cheresh can be translated as a deaf mute, but that would be kind of self-evident. A deaf mute can't read the Megillah. You can't say anything out loud. So the assumption here means somebody who can't hear, but they can speak. So a cheresh, someone who's deaf. A shote, which is someone who does not have mental competency. V'katan, and a child cannot read it. Why can those read it? Meaning if I just need to hear the words, so someone's a cheresh, so they can't hear it. But if they say it properly, and I can go like that, and you see now the King's Speech, remember the King's Speech, where he suffers from a debilitating stutter, George the Sixth. And the one way the speech therapist gets through to him is he plays very loud music in his ear and says, now read this, and he can't hear himself because he's just got the thing in his ear, and then he's being recorded, and Lady listens to the recording, and he reads flawlessly, without any stutter, because he was distracted and he couldn't hear himself speaking, and that kind of got him all shaken up. So, you know, he knew that even though he couldn't hear himself, that he was speaking, because afterwards he heard it and he get a thumbs up. So somebody's a cherish, they can't hear, and they start reading, and you go, meaning it's great. I can hear the Megillah. What difference does it make that they can't hear it? But they are out. A shota, someone who does have mental competency. So I'll say, I'm not said out loud now because I'll get my phone crazy, but I'll say something to engage AI and say, read Megillah for me. I hear it. It has to be read or heard from someone who is at least capable of internalizing this story, either because they're hearing it or they can process it mentally. And a katan can't do it either. Rabbi Yehuda Machshir b'katan. Rabbi Yehuda says a child can do it, which is unusual. Why would a child be able to do it? Is the question. Mantana. Who is it who teaches Cheresh Di'Aved Nami Lo? That a Cheresh, even B'di'Aved, can't do it. So now there's going to be, I mean, it's relatively straightforward next few lines, as long as you have the following question in mind. When the Mishnah says Cheresh Di'Aved Katan can't read it, does that mean L'chatzchila they can't read it, but B'di'Aved they can? Or does that mean even B'di'Aved, this doesn't work? Let's say I didn't know that they were Cheresh. Somebody, I went to a shul, I heard Megillah, beautifully done, beginning to end, and then afterwards, I go up to the person who laid Megillah and say, Yeshua Koach. They go, what? And I'm like, oh my gosh, this person can't hear. Which is, of course, they wouldn't say, huh, they would just ignore me. And say, oh my gosh, I just heard the whole Megillah from a Cheresh. Have I fulfilled my belief? It's B'di Eved. What is
it? Why would you be doing it if you
couldn't? So that's a good question. It could be that the community just doesn't know.
Well, it says no.
So the Mishnah says, lo yatza. Does that mean l'chatchila, or does that mean even b'di'eved lo yatza? That's going to be the question. So our assumption reading this is, drawer's assumption. It says, lo yatza. Sounds like full stop, doesn't work. So the Gemara asks, mantan achersh di'aved namale. Who is it who says that achersh, even b'di'eved, you don't fulfill your obligation? I'm not Rabbi Yossi. That's the view of Rabbi Yossi, ditnan, as it's taught in Brachot. Hakoret shema v'lo hishmei lo ozno yatza. The Mishnah in Brachot says, if you say Kriyat Shema, but you don't hear it with your own ears, you fulfill your obligation, even though L'chatchila sounds like you should. Rabbi Yossi Omer Lo Yatza. Rabbi Yossi says, you've not fulfilled your obligation, even B'di Eved. So you recite Kriyat Shema and you don't hear the words. This is why sometimes people say Kriyat Shema and it might like be irritating if someone next to you, they say it loudly. Like, I just want to focus. There is a halachic principle that has to be Mashmi Ala Ozno. When you read Kriyat Shema, you have to be able to hear yourself saying it. So Rabbi Yossi says, if you didn't do that, you have to do it again. You don't fulfill your obligation. What's it sound like? Umimai, Rabbi Yossi, the Avinamela. But hold on a minute. Who said our Mishnah says, Echershed V'katan, even B'di'Eved, you don't fulfill your obligation, in which case it's Rabbi Yossi. Dim Rabbi Yehuda, maybe it's Rabbi Yehuda, L'achila Hudala, Hudi Avid Shabib Dabi, but maybe Rabbi Yehuda is the author of our Mishnah, who said, Echershed V'katan, you can't read it for you. L'chatzchila, but B'di'Eved, it works. Maybe that's the case. Give me a reason why you'd say it can't be Rabbi Yehuda, who's the author of the beginning of our Mishnah, who says Cheshed V'Katan doesn't work, and it only means L'chatzchila.
He disagrees with himself.
Yes, he appears in the same Mishnah in a second, saying Machshir V'Katan. So we'll get to there in a minute. Lo Sachadatach, hold on a minute. Before we even get to that point, don't tell me that Diktani Cheresh, it says Cheshed V'Katan as a group. So, diktane cheresh dum yud shote v'katan. A cheresh is grouped together with shote and katan. Ma shote v'katan di avin nami lo. No one would say a shote, oh, b'di'eved, it's okay. It doesn't work. So, al cheresh di avin nami lo. So, it's one group. B'di'eved doesn't work. Gemara says that's not really tight logic. Dilma hakadita v'hakadita. Maybe they're just grouped together because it's not yatza, but one works b'di'eved and one doesn't. Diktane sefer, so then we can Jay's point. Rabbi Yehuda Machshir b'katan, mechal d'resh al avi b'ri. The fact that Rabbi Yehuda appears at the end of that Mishnah saying a katan's okay makes it sound like the person who says a katan isn't okay isn't Rabbi Yehuda. Skip the gray that's eliminated by Rashi and by a number of commentaries. V'dilma kul Rabbi Yehuda, maybe you could say the whole thing is Rabbi Yehuda. V'trei gavne k'tani k'tani. And there are two kinds of katan being spoken about. And there's a gap that we need to fill in the Mishnah. And actually it is Rabbi Yehuda across the board, but there's something that needs to be filled in. And this is how it should be read. Everyone can read the Megillah apart from Cheshed V'Katan, L'chatchila. In brackets, b'di'eved, it works. But my devar namurim, what are we talking about? B'kan shel hagil l'chinuch. We're talking about a child who's below the age of education. What's the age of chinuch traditionally? Say again. So it's interesting. Usually we take the view 7 or 8 in terms of when is there an obligation for children to start doing mitzvot. We say mishagil l'chinuch when they reach the age of education, and that's 7 or 8 is usually the age that we pick for that. Which means that they should have, you know, when we do a lulav sale, you know, a lot of times people will buy for kids like fake lulavs or something, you know, to get them excited. But when they get lechinuch, which is 7 or 8, there's a rabbinic obligation for them to fulfill the mitzvot as if they're adults. So there's a rabbinic obligation to get them a kosher lulav and everything else because of chinuch. So if it's under 7, Rabbi Yehuda says, you can't have a 5-year-old read the Megillah, lechatchila. B'dieved, it's okay. Aval b'katan shigil achinuch, but a katan who is already over 7 or 8, afilu chadchilash, even that works. Lechadchilash Rabbi Yehuda machshir b'katan, because Rabbi Yehuda allows a katan shigil achinuch. So that whole Mishnah could be Rabbi Yehuda, where he says, a 5-year-old can't read the Megillah for you, lechadchila, but an 8-year-old can read it, lechadchila, full stop. Now, we'll stop here because the Gemara is now going back and forth and say, hold on, maybe you misread that Mishnah from the Bracho entirely. And Rabbi Yehuda does not permit b'dieved. He only says, b'dieved isn't okay. Only chadchila is okay. We'll get to that next week and we'll do the different variations. In the meantime, I thank you. I wish you all a wonderful week. And we're going to meet next week and the week after, even though it's like 2 days before Pesach, if you're available, we'll meet. If you're not, I guess I'll just stand here and record it because we need to keep moving. But I thank you. I wish you all well.
Go for it.